We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour, we will return to a topic that we've discussed here on the program before. We'll be talking about nanotechnology. And if you're not sure what that is, very shortly here, we will give you a definition. Basically, it is a field that involves working on a very small scale, sometimes creating very small things. And there are many scientists who believe that nanotechnology has very large potential to change both our economy and also the way that we live. This morning, we will try to talk a little bit about some recent developments and research work in this field going on here at the University of Illinois. And in part, also, we will tell you about some of the things that are happening in connection with the annual Nanotechnology Workshop, sponsored by the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology, that will be coming up in early May. So it's just a couple of weeks away. If you're interested in finding out more about that, probably the easiest thing to do is go to their website, nano@Illinois. Oh, how about, CNST, that's Center for Nanoscale Science and Tech, cnst.illinois.edu. Otherwise, we'll talk a little bit more about it here this morning. We have three guests. Glad to have them here. Rashid Bashir is director of the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory. He's also professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. Irfan Ahmad is the associate director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. And also Joseph Cocchini, he is the associate dean for research in the College of ACES. He's also a professor of food engineering, director of the Illinois Agricultural Experiment Station here at the U of I, and we're pleased that they could all be here. Questions are welcome, and I'm sure that they will do their best to answer questions that people have. All you have to do is call us, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you also may email your questions to will-talk. That's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you all very much for being here. We appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
We've been doing to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the Nanotech Workshop. We've had a conversation about this time of year for quite a few years now. And
7 years.
7 years. And every time I come to this, I find myself again feeling that we need to try to define the territory. Technology, people know what that is. The nano part, that's the part that I think people aren't going to be sure about. Or they have read things about nanotech that may or may not be true. We have people using nano to sell things where that may have nothing to do with nano, nothing to do with nanotechnology. And then it is true that there actually are many consumer products now on the market that do, in fact, use nanotechnology. So I think people find this all really confusing. What's the most basic way that we can talk about what nanotechnology is?
Okay, so maybe I can go ahead and start.
Why don't you, Professor Bashir, why don't you start?
So nanotechnology, the word nano, actually the prefix nano, it means a billionth of a meter. Nanometer would be a billionth of a meter, so 10 to the minus 9. Nano is really 10 to the power of minus 9. And we talk about nanometer as being a billionth of a meter. So nanotechnology is really the field where we work at the scale of sort of 1 to 100 nanometer, broadly speaking, in that range of 1 to 100 nanometers. So as a comparison, just for a point of reference, the size of a human hair is actually, the diameter is about 100 microns. Micron is 10 to the minus 6 meter. The size of a DNA molecule, which is where the genetic code of all living things is, the diameter of a DNA molecule is just a few nanometers, just actually a couple of nanometers. The size of a virus, for example, a cold virus that we catch, would be in between 10 to 100 nanometers. So we're talking about things at that scale. And the very interesting thing about nanotechnology is that scientists and engineers and physicists and chemists and biologists have come up with ways to synthesize these structures using different methods. So we can work at that scale, and we can build structures and entities at that scale, and we can try to characterize them and measure them and examine them and look at them. So there's sort of multiple ways to build those structures. There's what we call bottoms-up approaches, which are more, you can think of it as sort of biological or chemical approaches. So things that are biological or chemical around us, they sort of self-assemble and they come together, and such as viruses or bacteria, and they're assembled by nature through some physical laws, and these structures are produced. So actually there's a lot that chemists and biologists can do to synthesize these nanostructures from the bottoms up. So it is different than chemical synthesis of molecules, but rather trying to synthesize structures that are larger than molecules, but smaller than many other sort of, you know, macro-scale structures.
Mm. And just so to make sure people understand, the building blocks that you're working with, right, are the same, are the building blocks of everything. We're not talking about something novel to start. We're talking about hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, whatever. It's the same things, but it has to do with your ability to put those things together
at that size scale,
in new ways, at a very small scale,
right,
working from the bottom,
exactly,
up to larger structures.
Right. So that's one approach, and then the second approach that comes sort of from the microelectronics industry, the fact that we are continuing to miniaturize what we can put on a silicon chip, so we can make things that are smaller and smaller. And actually, silicon industry today, the chip makers can make structures in silicon wafers that are at the nanoscale. So what's really exciting and interesting is the merger of these worlds, sort of the bottoms-up chemical and biological world and the top-down silicon world. And at that scale, then, there is sort of new properties emerge, and the synthesis of materials can be performed at that scale in a very controllable fashion, mm-hmm, leading to new properties and new functionalities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You want to
So some of it, as Rashid was saying, is so we could also envision it as some people have called it atomic technology, so atom at a time. So basically you're able to put the atoms together and engineer materials at that level, at the nanoscale level, where the properties are different and unique and novel, and there you are able to develop processes, devices, and sensing materials or sensors to go about with various applications. And so, and then a whole lot of applications or products which come about, and you had alluded to some of the commercially available products right now. So among them are like using carbon nanotubes in tennis rackets, or nanoparticles for your sunscreens and the like, and then the non-abrasive materials for your sunglasses or towels and the like, or self-cleaning materials for windows and so on and so forth, and nanocomposite materials for bumpers, and so for making it abrasion proof.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I know that you wanted to talk about was applications within agricultural science and tech. And so that's why Professor Cocchini is here. Would you want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the way of research in ACES that has to do with nanotech?
Yes, I will be happy to. And perhaps if I can start by bringing my own perspective that complements my colleague's perspective. You know, many different molecules have a lot of different surface forces that actually attracts them towards one another. You know, this is one of the ways in which molecules self-assemble, you know, in the form of structures that have very unique properties. I think, you know, in the field of agriculture, the applications have been particularly focused on delivery systems using nanoparticles. And here what we do is to take bioactive compounds. You must have heard of lycopene, for example, that does a lot of good to your prostate. Mm-hmm. And we encapsulate lycopene in these nanoparticles. And the nanoparticles can be constructed from polymers, or they can be constructed from emulsions. And then we tag them with proteins that help them recognize the prostate. And then we send them through the gut membranes. And because they're very small, they can go through the gut membranes and ultimately find themselves in the blood and ultimately be delivered to the prostate as one example. And this is an area that has, you know, taken off quite significantly, in particular in the food industry. There are, you mentioned earlier that some products have actually found themselves in the marketplace. There are a number of edible food products that have emerged that contain these nanoparticles. There are drinks, for example, that are loaded with ginseng. The consumer basically recognizes that ginseng is in the drink because it's labeled. But the technology that delivers it and essentially gives it a stealth property is actually the utilization of nanoemulsions. Mm-hmm. And because they're very, very tiny, they are smaller than the wavelength of light, and they remain transparent to light. So essentially the drink looks identical to the drink that doesn't contain ginseng. So that's one technology that has found itself in the marketplace. And then, you know, my colleague Irfan, Dr. Ahmad, has actually mentioned, you know, various creams. And in fact, emulsion products are, you know, very natural carriers for these particles. And gels are, you know, very nice carriers for these particles. So this is one avenue of technology, science and technology, you know, that has delivered and is in the process of delivering. I think there are other emerging areas, in particular in food safety. My colleague, Professor Bashir, is a leader in this particular area. There are a number of devices that are in the process of being developed that actually capture microorganisms that have pathogenic properties like E. coli, like Salmonella, quickly characterize them and measure their concentration. One of these, in fact, was invented in Professor Bashir's lab. And for this, you know, he has been internationally recognized for his work. And there are a number of different applications which are emerging that are focused on what we like to think of as microfluidic devices. And these are essentially small chips. They contain very tiny channels, and liquids can actually be circulated through these very tiny micron level or 100 nanometer level channels. Microorganisms can be captured in various locations and concentrated, and then with detection tools actually being detected. This particular technology has given us the ability to come up with a number of different tools. So this is on the food end of things. There are also very interesting applications focused on agriculture. Some of the projects that we are currently focusing on, Professor Irfan Ahmed has actually mentioned the use of carbon nanotubes. One of our colleagues in the college, in collaboration with a faculty person in the Micro and Nanotechnology Center, is looking at the incorporation of nanotubes into seeds. When this happens, it appears that nanotubes are able to actually concentrate moisture better in the seed, so the seed germinates actually faster. And ultimately, the plant, you know, produces, grows faster and produces more tomatoes. I mean, this is a system that has been experimented with. And there's published data that shows that, you know, there are more tomatoes that are grown as a result of the introduction of carbon nanotubes. But there are also other devices that are being developed for animal and plant health. We have colleagues in the crop sciences department, Professor Lila Vatkin, working with Professor Brian Cunningham, that actually has looked at the development of more precise detection devices that are able to determine the expression of genes at a much more sensitive level. These utilize photonic materials, and I will let Professor Bashir jump in here and talk a little bit about these photonic devices.
So, yeah, that was explained very, very eloquently by Dr. Kokini. I think the diagnostic devices is certainly a big area of research, and it's a big area of strength on campus. There's a range of applications, and in the area of food safety and detection of pathogens, whether they're microbial or viral particles, there's a lot of work going on. There's multiple technologies that are being brought to bear to address this grand challenge. It's really a national need and a grand challenge. So there are photonic devices that researchers are working on, Professor Brian Cunningham and others, where the idea is that when you capture pathogens on these special nanostructured surfaces, the surfaces have nanoscale properties, and they can essentially reflect the light back at a much higher intensity at specific wavelengths, or they could trap light, so they're like two-dimensional diffraction gratings, and you can essentially get a much more sensitive, much more enhanced signal of detection. So you can detect microorganisms or viruses or bacteria or even biomolecules like DNA or proteins at unprecedented sensitivities. Other methods include charges also, like charge detection. So biomolecules and many biological entities actually have a charge, the same kind of charge that electric current carries. And this charge can be detected using, for example, silicon transistors, the same transistors that are used in your microprocessors and memories and in your iPods and iPhones. Those same transistors could be used to detect charge of molecules in fluid. And hence, you can use these transistors to detect viruses and proteins and DNA, again, on a chip. So the idea of lab on a chip, or the idea of one point of care or point of test devices where you could take a sample of fluid, introduce it on your, let's say, like a memory stick, essentially, and it will tell you almost instantaneously what's present in that fluid and at what concentration, and then have that plugged into your phone and have the data been transmitted to some central location. So that's sort of the vision for this individualized highly sensitive detection for either medical applications or for agricultural applications, where you want to, at a point of test, detect the presence of pathogens in soil or well water or different sources of fluid. I think the applications of diagnostics actually are broader also in the area of cancer. So there's work going on where we'd like to be able to take body fluids such as serum or saliva or breast aspirate to detect specific cancer proteins or cancer markers, which are indicative of the stage of the disease. So there's a lot of emphasis on really early detection of diseases such as cancer. So there is multiple projects going on in that area where nanosensors are being used for early detection of cancer proteins. The idea of microfluidics was explained very well by Professor Kokini. So the small channels on a chip that can be patterned and formed using nanofabrication techniques to manipulate fluids and to manipulate cells. So there are projects, for example, that are targeted towards the area of global health, where for detection of HIV and AIDS, what you want to be able to do, that's really a huge grand challenge worldwide. The Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, is really investing a lot of money in that general area. And one of the biggest problems is detection. How do you detect? How can you very quickly take a sample of blood from an individual let's say just a drop of blood, which is about 10 to 20 microliters, and detect and count the specific types of white blood cells. And when the count of these white blood cell drops, it means that the immune system is being attacked or being mm-hmm. compromised. Mm-hmm. So to give therapy to those individuals, you need to first diagnose them. And in this case, you want to be able to take the sensor and the chip to the patient rather than the patient to the lab. So the idea of lab on a chip and then putting the lab in the patient's hand, essentially, rather than taking the patient to the lab. So the area of lab on a chip is actually very broad, and it really encompasses nanotechnology as an enabling technology.
Hmm. Let me reintroduce our guests, and then also we have a caller here I want to bring into the conversation. The last person you heard, that's Rashid Bashir. He's director of the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory at the U of I. He's also a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering and in Bioengineering. Joseph Cocchini is Associate Dean for Research in the College of ACES. He is also Professor of Food Engineering. And Irfan Ahmad is the Associate Director of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology here at the University of Illinois, also on research faculty in the Department of Agricultural and Biological Engineering. And we're talking here about some of the work done by people here at the University of Illinois in the area of nanotechnology. Coming up on May 6th and 7th, the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology will be sponsoring their annual Nanotech Workshop for 2010, and we'll talk a little bit more about that and give you, again, the website if you'd like to find out more. I have a caller here I want to bring into the conversation. Other people who are listening can call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk at illinois.edu. This caller is in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Two things. One, they may not understand, but you might. I'm thinking about HAL and how Illinois took over the computer situation and ended up being in an important movie later on in life. The question I'm interested in, maybe speculative, don't know that much about it from the biological side, but do you ever run across topological concerns at this smallness from the mathematical side? And if so, how do you adapt or adopt them? Or do you use them in any way? Or is this simply positive and negative attractions and configurations you push together in some way chemically? Thanks.
Well, that question is completely beyond me. Do you get the drift of the caller?
I can make some comments about, I guess, the need for computation in that area, and that's something maybe that we can address. I think you know, we can experimentally work on these systems, but certainly being able to model and simulate, you know, what happens at this scale is a very, very important area, and we have tremendous strengths on campus, actually, in that area. So being able to model a certain number of atoms and sort of doing the simulation from the bottoms up and how these atoms and molecules interact under certain situations, especially in fluids, I think that's maybe what the caller is alluding to. And there's certainly that's a very important area of research. And it's very critical, especially in terms of how simulation and design of nanostructures needs to also guide the experiment, because experiments are also very, very expensive. So as much as we can, we try to work with our computational counterparts and computational collaborators, collaborators who are doing computation and theory of nanostructures. And that's certainly a very important piece of nanotechnology, the whole area of computational nanotechnology.
And if I can add to Professor Bashir's comments, this whole area of mathematical simulation at the molecular or nanoscale is actually called molecular dynamics simulation. And it takes into account the various types of forces that are involved in the process of bringing atoms and molecules together and how structures can form. As Professor Bashir mentioned, it is then possible to design these particles knowing essentially how they will interact with one another in very special ways. So it basically offers the opportunity to do some computer-assisted design of nanoparticles in a way that now, at the macro scale, we design cars. You know, if we understand how molecules come together and ultimately how they can perform, then we can put them together in a very tailored way so that they deliver the functionalities, the properties, that we are interested in. And in fact, as Professor Bashir mentioned, this gives us a tremendous amount of capabilities in terms of coming up with new particles, new technologies, new designs that actually move the field forward.
So there are several faculty members who are engaged in computational nanotechnology research, and Professor Klaus Schulten is one of them, and he also heads a NIH Resource Center on campus, which actually provides those sort of simulation and software and the tools to conduct that. And several faculty members in both in mechanical engineering and civil engineering are working on some of those aspects, including ion channels and nanopores. And then, again, as the colleagues mentioned, I mean, simulating all of that and then maybe going to the next stage of putting it into an experiment. Mm.
Well, let's, before we go too much further, I don't want to find us out of time and not give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about the workshop.
Okay, sure. So this workshop, sponsored by the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology, has been a regular feature of this campus since 2003. And I think, as mentioned earlier, I think the first set of interviewers that you interviewed was in 2003 when the inaugural workshop was held in May. And since that time, I mean, so this center, of course, giving you a little bit of history, was established by the campus through the Provost Office and the College of Engineering Dean's Office in terms of putting a seed money to help pull together all the nanotechnology research on campus. So we call this as a collaboratory. So it's a virtual center bringing together several other major nanotechnology labs, including the micro nanotechnology lab and the materials research lab, the Beckman Institute, the Coordinated Science Lab, and the Institute for Genomic Biology, and then the several other major departments which are part of all of this activity. We're talking about 150-some researchers across campus, including the 10 or so colleges and units. And so this particular workshop that is coming up on May 6th and 7th is an annual feature, and it features policymakers. And in this case, we are getting a keynote speaker from the National Science Foundation, who has been a proponent of nanotechnology. He's a senior advisor on nanotechnology, Mihail Roko, at the National Science Foundation. And previously, we have had speakers from NIH and the National Cancer Institute and the like. And also, it is also a good opportunity for the faculty and students to come together and be appreciative of each other's research, but also to bring about these multidisciplinary partnerships which come about because of these workshops. Mm-hmm. And so some of these workshops actually led to the formation of these multidisciplinary teams at the center level, and several of those initiatives have turned into now the funding from the National Science Foundation and potentially from NIH and NCI, National Cancer Institute, they're leading to very involved center-level initiatives and projects. And also, it also highlights the students' participation through poster presentations, and where students are judged for poster awards and the like. It is open to the, again, So when the center goes about taking its business, it's not only the research component, but also the education component and the training component. And over the last couple of years, we have had hands-on trainings conducted here on campus, again, under different funding schemes, both at the cellular mechanics, mechanobiology level, and using also laboratories like the micro-nanotechnology lab, the Beckman Institute, the bioengineering department, and the veterinary medicine for conducting hands-on training. We're making students and junior faculty available, aware of the two areas. So the engineers being exposed to cell culture techniques and the cell and the biologists being exposed to micro nanofabrication techniques. Mm-hmm. So those again are brought to bear through these center level initiatives. So this the lab then has the center itself has also the outreach component. So including reach out to K-12 and including working with the entities like the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry, where we're partnering with the Micro Nanotechnology Lab and the NanoChems, which is another manufacturing center on campus, to have a nano exhibit at the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry, working with colleagues in the Midwest. This particular workshop that is coming this year, we are also putting a regional focus to it. So we have invited a number of faculty members around different neighboring states to become part of this, what we envision to be like the Midwest corridor for the micro/nanotechnology research and development, both in the terms of medical and pharmaceutical application, but also in agricultural and food application, and to be the hub for such an activity, because we already have a number of industry which are based in Illinois and in the adjoining regions, and that really lends itself for us to, in this resource-constrained environment that we find ourselves in, we have to be creative in putting together these teams and initiatives. And so one of the ideas in this workshop would be to also have these panel discussions and come about with strategies how to collaborate more. And there are several other initiatives which are there. One of them is the Center for Agriculture Pharmaceutical Nanotechnology, which is Illinois-Purdue collaboration. There's one already existing, the Nanotechnology Computational Network, which is, again, Illinois-Purdue collaboration going on. And then we have one already currently towards coming to an end in the Seidman Center for Cancer Nanotechnology Excellence with Washington University in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And then Rashid can comment on one with the Indiana University, Purdue University, with the BRP that you have, and another one on the USDA on food safety.
Well, you know, the caller made reference to HAL, the computer from 2001. I don't think we're quite at that point of artificial intelligence yet, and I don't know if we ever will be, but it makes you wonder the potential for this technology and what that might mean to this campus, let us say, in another 10 years or 15 years. As this kind of technology continues to develop, and we get particularly past the sort of passive nanotech structures that we have now, to the kinds of things that people have imagined, where we actually have nano machines. What sort of potential do you see for this technology for this campus? And you know, feel free to go out 10 or 15 years, maybe.
So I think, that's a very good point. And I think, there's tremendous applications and there's a lot of work going on in what I would call sort of, ex vivo or outside the body in terms of diagnostic mm-hmm. devices. So there are mm-hmm. diagnostic devices, there are nanoparticles used for detection of biological mm-hmm. entities outside the body. But then there's lots of applications which are more in vivo. I think there's tremendous opportunities there, and of course we have to approach those opportunities with the appropriate caution. With looking at all of the issues like toxicity and the environmental impact and the issues on health, and all of those things have to be regulated. So we do that very carefully and always bring all the right partners in. And I'm sure Professor Kokini can expand on that more too. I think in the area of sort of active nanostructures, one of the things I can briefly mention is that we were recently on campus awarded a center from NSF that's a partnership between MIT, Georgia Tech, and University of Illinois with sort of an equal contribution from these three institutions and equal funding that comes to these three institutions. It's led by Professor Jimmy Shah, who's a professor in mechanical engineering here at University of Illinois, but it has really collaborators from like 10 different departments. I mean, it's all across from including biology, chemistry, tissue engineering, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, bioengineers. And the idea of the center, or the goal of this, is to forward engineer biological structures. So just like today you can design a you know, a synthetic structure. You can design, you know, you have some design rules and you have some guidelines and you have some building blocks and you can build machines. The goal of the center is to start, you know, to start thinking about in this area what's called synthetic biology, where you want to, you know, forward engineer biological structures. So it's different than tissue engineering where you're trying to mimic an organ. But in this particular area of synthetic biology, you want to be able to design with biological entities. And nanotechnology plays an important role. It's an enabling technology to do that, to be able to use novel biomaterials, nanostructured biomaterials, nanotechnology tools to characterize materials and image them at that scale. You use microfluidics and nanosensors. But the idea is to actually use cells as the building blocks to build soft materials. So if you could take a muscle cell, which is known to actuate and move, and take a cell from the nervous system, from the neuron, you know, the neuron cells, which we know can sense and transmit signals, and so let's say endothelial cells, which provide the vasculature, and with those three, sort of use cells as a machine and use cells to put the cells together to come up with some building blocks for biological machines. So I think that very much is in that realm that you just asked, and certainly it's a very interesting field, a lot of possibilities, but we also approach it with caution in terms of what the implications could be.
Yeah. You know, that's something that I want to ask about, and nanotech seems to have some very exciting potential applications in agriculture, in medicine, in other kinds of engineering.
Material science, and
certainly, I suppose it's fine to have high tech tennis rackets, and maybe it's a good thing that our pants, if you spill wine on them, that, you know, they don't get stained. But but there are some people who are concerned about the potential on the environment and human health of these materials. And for example, just one example, we have mentioned a couple times, we mentioned carbon nanotubes. Well, there are some people who are very concerned about carbon nanotubes. They're very, very small. Their ability to penetrate into the body is known, and there are some people who are concerned, for example, that carbon nanotubes could be a problem as bad or worse than asbestos for their ability to penetrate the lungs and to cause an illness like asbestos can cause. So right there, there's a question, well, how concerned should we be about that? Is that a big problem? How do we think about that?
These are valid concerns, and so they, and when we talk about it, and that's the component we talk about, the societal implications of nanotechnology, which includes the environmental aspect of, when we are putting materials into the body, the healthcare aspect, legal aspect, which come about. So there have been studies. There are colleagues who are studying here at the College of Veterinary Medicine, and also in the civil and environmental engineering, but also at other universities where they have been studying the toxicity effects of that and the environmental impact of that. But that's the discussion which continues to be should continue to occur as the research and development is going on, and there is also a move to standardize some of these procedures, standardize the particles, and so there the legal community is also coming into, and so there have been some talks and research or proposals being floated on those guidelines.
And you know, building on Professor Ahmed's comments. At this point in time, you know, there is an emerging body of literature about the susceptibility of various kinds of cells to nanoparticles, but there is not yet any solid evidence that they indeed do successfully penetrate various cellular systems and, in fact, you know, interact with the DNA and so on and so forth. It is possible that all these things might happen because, you know, they are able to actually penetrate various membranes. And in fact, you know, as Irfan was mentioning earlier, we are forming a team here at the University of Illinois to begin to look in various in vitro systems to begin with. Whether nanoparticles, in fact, you know, can cause various kinds of cellular damage. Mm-hmm. I think it is probably going to become the most significant research area in the next 5 to 10 years. There's already a center that has been funded by the National Science Foundation at Rice University to look at the environmental impact of nanoparticles. And as of yet, that center has not published any new information that suggests that we need to be excessively cautious about nanoparticles.
Well, let me ask you about one thing in particular which I have read about, and that is nanotitanium dioxide, which, as I understand, and you can tell me if you think that it's not correct, that it actually has been demonstrated in the laboratory, in vitro and in lab animals, to be damaging to DNA and chromosomes, that's actually been shown to be the case, and that it's something that's actually widely in use in a lot of consumer products.
Yes? So I think so that has to do with the doses that are used, and that might end up getting to let's say animals or individuals. I mean, the point that I think that Dr. Kokani was also trying to make is that I think we need to understand that a lot more and study that in more detail. But just looking ahead, what might end up happening is that just like there's so many other chemicals and materials that have to be regulated, or the use or the doses. I mean, we know there's some, there's so many standards. And so I think the nanomaterials, the point is that there is some tremendous benefits, and there might be some things that we have to be very cautious with and essentially regulate the concentration and the doses. So some of those studies that you're talking about, that's true. I mean, I think at very high doses, you can take lots of different materials and they might causing some harm. Yeah. So I think one has to look at that from that perspective and determine the thresholds and determine the doses that would cause a negative impact, and then work with the federal agencies to try to regulate them. And that's really the approach that's being taken right now, is that we need to understand a lot more. We need to develop those standards and those toxicity levels.
I guess the concern I suppose some people would have is not so much that kind of work's not being done, but that where a lot of resources are being put into research for applications of the biotechnology, because obviously that people think that that's very exciting and there's possibility of making money that way, and much fewer resources being put into this kind of study to talk about environmental and health impacts, right. And that at least we ought to be looking at least as hard at potential impacts as we are, potential negative impacts as we do as potential positive impacts.
So let me give you one other example. There are these things called quantum dots, which are semiconductor materials that are at that scale of a few tens of nanometers, and they're used as imaging probes. And these are commercially available. You can purchase these quantum dots today. Mm-hmm. And they can be introduced into fluids, and they can try to target specific biological molecules or DNA for imaging purposes, for the use in research labs or in academic labs or for diagnostic purposes. But it's very clear that they are for that purpose. When studies were done, and this has been reported, that cadmium selenide quantum dots or some other semiconductor quantum dots do affect cells negatively. So you would never use them for applications that are in vivo. It's just very clear now. So I think for some of the other materials, those studies are being done. And as those studies come about, the point is that then, standards are established and it's known that, okay, this material affects it at this dose, and hence you won't use it for that application. And again, the materials are no more dangerous or toxic than many other things that I can think of that would cause those issues that are being regulated today. We use lots of other chemicals in chemistry and biology labs that end up, that could do similar kind of damage to cells, but we don't use them for those applications.
Well, would the greatest problem of exposure be to people who might have industrial exposure to them more so than things that are in consumer products?
So I have reviewed some proposal from NIOSH, and they are regulating some of those. And so, what would be a potential exposure to a worker? And so they have developed these standards. So if you were to be handling the nanoparticles or manufacturing them, so you have to use a mask and so on and so forth, and those standardizations are occurring. So NIOSH is very much onto it, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. And so So there is that part is going on as far as the worker safety is concerned. And similar standards could potentially be also introduced on campuses and through the IRBs and the institutional review boards and the Office of the Vice Chancellor for Research and the like, when students and faculty are handling those sort of materials. I mean, and that's the discussion which some of the lawyers have brought to the forefront in terms of so that nanotechnology does not face the same uphill battle which biotechnology faced because of the lack of public's acceptance to it. And that's why NSF is putting a lot of the dollars to that in terms of funding research in that area. And most recently, they funded a Center for Environmental Implication at Duke University, which our campus also competed for getting that center. And so there is a push both at the NSF level, the National Institute of Health level, to address those issues.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's kind of interesting, and I don't know if Dr. Kokini has thought about this, that it seems that people are much more concerned about genetically modified food than they are about products that involve nanotechnology. And I don't know if that's because they actually don't really understand, I mean, and I don't really either, understand what nanotechnology is, or that it hasn't been, the level of awareness, the media coverage that it's gotten is not quite so high. I guess I'm wondering why would people have that different, a very different response to those two technologies, where one of them they'd say, I don't want to have anything to do with that. But the other, they don't seem to be really concerned particularly about it at all.
Well, genetically modified foods, have been around for a long time. I think biotechnology and genetic modifications have resulted in new forms of biological materials, essentially for several decades. Nanotechnology is a relatively new technology, and there is not a significant body of knowledge, focusing on concerns related with nanotechnology. But as you said earlier, the public is beginning to be more and more concerned, and there's more and more pressure to actually come up with data that either shows that nanoparticles are non-toxic or the reverse. And I think within these centers at Duke and at Rice and some of the work that goes on at the University of Illinois, as new data emerges, we will see the public asking a lot of questions. I think the European public has already started asking a lot of hard questions and, wants to see much more toxicological work done. And I think, we'll pretty much see the same sort of concern in the U.S. But I think, the difference between nanotechnology and biotechnology is the fact that nanotechnology is trying to be very transparent about the impact of nanomaterials on human, animal, plant health. We all as a community are equally focused on these impacts as we are about developing new nanomaterials. I think genetically modified materials have reached the public without enough information about their safety. When some studies began to emerge that really were not based on solid facts, but simply created fear in the public, in particular in Europe, suddenly we saw a very significant concern on the part of the public. In this particular case, we're making every effort, to try and provide the toxicological data, look at nanomaterials in detail, make these available to the public, inform the public about both the good and the possible risks. And we hope that nanotechnology is not going to go through the same path as biotechnology has gone through.
Mm.
David, I'd like to add that we see that nanotechnology as, and personally I see that as a great bridge builder between the developed nations and developing nations. And what do I mean by that is that so some of the major issues confronting us on the planet, including water, access to clean drinking water, availability of water, global health, as was alluded to earlier, and energy. These are multi-dimensional, very complex the issues which can only be addressed in a collaborative framework. And nanotechnology is that bridge which can put together the solutions which would be more useful both for developed and the developing nation. And we, through this campus, have also proposed establishment of some of these centers for nanotechnology for applications in developing countries and the like. So when we talk about global health issues then confront us because of the global connectivity. Now you have the incidences of the H1N1 or SARS virus or the West Nile virus or tuberculosis. So those can potentially impact us here. And so that's why there have to be solutions which are which come about through these multi-institution, multi-country framework and also can fit under the United Nations Millennium Development Goals and the like. And so that's why we have to see all of this coming together. So these discussions can continue at our upcoming Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology workshop, which is open to the public. And so anyone can go to this CNST website or the MNTL website. The website I can give again is www.cnst.illinois.edu and sign up for it. And we look forward for a good workshop.
We're trying to get one more caller in real quick on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Quick question. We've heard of all the benefits that are promised. I was wondering, and we talk about nanotechnology as it's one unified field. I was wondering what are the interests, institutions and corporations that are pushing this research, in what directions are they taking it, and what directions are they ignoring?
And that's a wonderful question, and I can give you about a minute to talk about it.
So I think in general, this is really a very pervasive area of research across many institutions. I mean, certainly all the top research institutions around the U.S. and around the world. There's work going on here at University of Illinois and in the region and across the country in the area of nanoelectronics. So electronics, nanotechnology applied to electronic materials. What is the next transistor? What is the ends of Moore's law? And can nanotechnology provide a solution via carbon nanotubes or graphene transistors, for example? Nanomedicine, which is the area of some of the projects we discussed, applications of nanotechnology to diagnostics and therapeutics for human health, let's say. Nanotechnology for the environment and for agriculture, that's a huge area in terms of drinking water, the quality of food, food safety, that whole area. Computational nanotechnology, trying to understand these materials and these systems by simulations. Nanomaterials is also a big area, trying to come up with new materials that are self-healing, that are much stronger than existing materials, and things of the like.
Energy.
And there, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop. We're at the end of the time. Just if you're interested in finding out more about the annual Nanotech Workshop for 2010, go to the website www.cnst.illinois.edu. Our thanks to Rashid Bashir, Joseph Kokini, and Irfan Ahmad. Thanks very much for being
with
us.
Thank you.